This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North. The specter of nuclear destruction was unleashed at the end of the Second World War when the United States dropped two nuclear bombs on Japan. From 1945 until today, the fear of nuclear annihilation has waxed and waned, probably peaked during the height of the Cold War in the 1950s and 60s, and it lessened when the Soviet Union collapsed 30 years ago and the two superpowers seemed willing to disarm and eradicate their nuclear stockpiles. But our next guest says that while things are better, the arms race is heating up again. Joseph Cerincione is president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security, nonpartisan, and nonprofit foundation that focuses on nuclear disarmament. For more than 35 years, he's been working to rid the world of nuclear weapons. He was in town earlier this month to speak at UW-Milwaukee, and he joined us in the studio then. Joe, it's great to see you again. Thanks for stopping by.
Well, thank you, Bonnie. I love Milwaukee, and it's always great to come here by the studio.
Well, we're talking about something, however, that is very serious and not fun, but so important, and that is nuclear disarmament. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, with everything going on in the world right now, is nuclear disarmament on people's minds?
It's sporadically on their minds. And I understand that. There's lots of threats. There's lots of challenges we face in the world today. And it's easy to get discouraged by that. But of all the challenges we face, there are only two that threaten destruction on a planetary scale. And that's climate change and nuclear weapons. Climate change can destroy human civilization over decades. Nuclear weapons can do it in an afternoon. So while it is not at any given point necessarily an immediate threat, it's something you have to work on and it's something you have to be aware of because things can go wrong very, very quickly. And we're starting to feel some of that here in the United States with the turbulence in the White House. And it reminds us that we have a system where the President of the United States has sole unfettered authority to launch a nuclear weapon anytime he wants for whatever reason he wants. So this is something that might not be top of mind, but it is central to our continued existence.
One of the things about nuclear weapons and disarmament is I think a lot of people feel that it has been taken care of,
we
did that already. But there are still so many nations, ourselves included, that have a huge stockpile.
Yeah, right. Well, the good news is we did take care of a lot of it. And it shows that policy matters and the choices we make as a nation matter. So over the last 40 years or so, started by Ronald Reagan, really, with his Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the treaty that broke the back of the arms race, the U.S. and Russia have been steadily reducing their massive nuclear arsenals. We look back now and we realize we went nuclear nuts. At the time Reagan was negotiating this treaty with then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, there were about 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world, 70,000, and the U.S. and the Soviets had about 95% of them. So we've come down to about 14,000, so a big, big drop. Steady series of negotiations, talks, agreements, Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, most of the heavy lifting done by Republican presidents, interestingly enough. But there's still 14,000 nuclear weapons, and most of these are hydrogen bombs, very, very large weapons, many times the size of the Hiroshima bomb, held by nine different nations. And the reductions have stopped. The talks about reductions have stopped. Each of these nine nations, whether it's little North Korea or big United States, are building new weapons and starting, in some cases, for us and for Russia, a new generation of weapons. So we're at an inflection point. And the decisions we make over the next couple of years will likely determine the course of the next 20 or 30, because these weapons last a long time. And if you build them now, they're going to be with you for a generation or more.
So what changed? What made that reverse?
A lot of it was politics. So, for example, when President Obama continued the Reagan series of treaties, the START Treaty, it was called, Strategic Arms Reduction Talks, when he started to renew that agreement with the Russians back in 2009 and lower the level. He brought it before the Senate for ratification. The Republicans opposed it for political reasons. They didn't want to give a Democratic president a victory in a Republican year. And it really brought the arms control process pretty much to a halt. Obama succeeded in adopting that treaty, in the last day of the Senate, December 2010, but that was it. The Obama team was exhausted by the process. It required enormous political capital, and they switched to some of the other pressing issues. They did other things. They reduced the threat in other ways, but as far as reduction process, that was it. And now you get President Trump, who has an opposition to all things Obama. So you see he pulled out of his climate change accord. He tried to repeal the Health Care Act. He got out of the agreement with Iran that Obama had negotiated. And now he has Obama's New START treaty, which has an expiration date, like most treaties. It expires January 2021. Is Trump going to renew it? No, he's not. As former National Security Advisor John Bolton said, why should we renew a flawed treaty? They claim it's too weak, it didn't go far enough, but there's nothing to replace it. So here we are looking at the end of this reduction process. If this treaty is not renewed in early 2021, it will be the first time since 1972 that the Russian and U.S. arsenals have not had some kind of control over them. And when you take away the guardrails, all kinds of crazy things can happen. All kinds of crazy weapons get proposed, like that Russian nuclear-powered cruise missile that crashed a few weeks ago and in the recovery process killed seven of the technicians that were trying to bring it back. And that's when things start to spiral out of control. And that's when other countries see the U.S. and Russia racing on nuclear arms. And they go, well, we want to be part of this game, too. And they start building up their arsenals. So unless you act soon, like keep the New START treaty, get a new president that or this president that with new talks, you're going to spiral back into the Cold War arms race.
Well, and one of the things you mentioned, you're talking about talks and diplomacy. The U.S. Foreign Service is in dire straits
disarray,
right now.
In disarray.
And that really is the pointy end of the spear for all of that. Having a good, strong diplomatic corps is kind of what we need to have. And so how do you see that getting rectified?
Unfortunately, the State Department has been gutted in recent years, and this was intentional. The Trump administration saw the State Department as part of the deep state, so people who would oppose the president's wishes. So they cut the budget by 30%.
And it was never high. The State Department always had the lowest budget, I think.
That's right. People think that we are lavish or generous in our foreign aid to other countries. And we're a big nation and we have global responsibilities and we do give a significant amount of aid. But it is a pittance compared to the military budget that we have. I think the entire State Department budget is about $36 billion and we spend $738 billion on the military. That just gives you some perspective here. So they cut the budget by a third, then they're slow to appoint officials, and there's been a revolving door of officials in and out of the State Department. For example, there's no longer an undersecretary for arms control and national security. There was one. She did an okay job, but she was abruptly fired last month because she wasn't sufficiently loyal to President Trump. So now we have nobody guiding these kinds of talks, these kinds of discussions, negotiations, monitoring of existing arms control treaties. It's a real problem. It's like we're trying to keep the world safe with two-thirds of the budget we used to have and half the personnel, and you can't really do that.
So what do we do? How do we change this?
Well, there's two things. I mean, I run a foundation called Plowshares Fund, and we have a saying that we support policies, not presidents. So we're not partisan. We don't pick a president and back everything they do or oppose a president and try to stop everything they do. So when it comes to President Trump, there are a couple of things that he has gotten started that we like. He has started negotiations with North Korea. Bits and starts, not very well done, not a very clear plan, but he's broken the taboo against talking to a North Korean leader. So that's something we should all should be supporting. And unfortunately, I see too many Democrats kind of trying to get to the right of Donald Trump and pick on him and object to him talking to the North Korean leader, opposing the very act of diplomacy rather than trying to help the president find the right course. That's one way you could do it. Same with Iran. We have new reports that President Trump and the president of Iran, Mr. Rouhani, came very close to reaching an agreement at the UN. Apparently, French President Macron had negotiated a four-point statement that both sides would agree to. It almost worked, but the Iranians ran into political difficulties back home. They have their own intense politics and couldn't quite arrange the phone call, couldn't quite sign it. But that, again, is a promising overture that I would hope that Democrats would support.
Talking about talking to North Korea, I was reminded, because I'm old enough to remember this, was there similar opposition to Nixon talking to China?
Nixon was very smart. He and Kissinger surprised everybody. There was no prelude. There was no exchange of love letters. You know, they just did it. Kissinger just showed up in Beijing, and then, seemingly overnight, Nixon was there toasting Mao Zedong, an historic meeting. And it shows us that sometimes, only a Republican can take these kinds of steps. You can imagine what would have happened if a Democrat had done that. If Jimmy Carter, for example, had done that years later, the right would have attacked him as an appeaser, as being weak. So ironically, sometimes leaders who were most opposed to our adversaries are the only ones who can make the deal with them. Because the Republican Party will trust that leader to be clear-eyed about it, the Democrats will swing in control, which is why most of the arms control agreements we've had have come from Republican leaders, whether it's China or negotiations that Reagan left or led or agreements that Nixon led or H.W. Bush. H.W. Bush is probably the biggest nuclear disarmament president in history. He got rid of 14,000 so-called tactical nuclear weapons unilaterally. No treaty, no agreement, just said we don't need these anymore and got rid, denuclearized the army, took all the nuclear weapons off the Navy surface ships back in 1991. A sweeping gesture. Only a Republican could have done that. A Democrat probably would have been impeached.
Probably. Well, and also H.W. Bush came out of the military himself and also the CIA. And
right.
He
so
had
trusted.
A very different he was trusted and he had a very different mean. Mm-hmm. People knew he had this background.
Yeah.
There's times when I think, the Cold War that we thought we left by. I was in the military in the early 80s and I was stationed in Europe. And that's what we were focused on, mm-hmm. Of course. We were waiting for the balloon to go up or
yes.
Praying that it wasn't going to, but waiting for that. And all of our missions were dedicated to preventing that or alerting if something happened. And I think, wow, that this has happened again. I think what we were afraid of once that all went away was that it was going to be rogue states
right.
that would have the nuclear capabilities and do something.
And that was correct. That was a correct assessment.
Yeah.
I happened to be in Berlin the week the wall came down in November.
30 years ago.
30 mm-hmm. years ago, right. I was just invited to the German embassy in Washington for the 30th anniversary celebration. I'm hoping to go. And there was a party going on, man. This was just unbelievable. I think I was one of the last people to walk through Checkpoint Charlie. When I went in the morning from west to east, there were guards checking my passport. When I came back in the afternoon, they were all gone, and the gates were open. And those years that followed were very, very rapid, a little confusing, a little disorienting. But what we realized was, one, we had a chance to really stand down the Cold War apparatus. And fortunately, President Reagan and President H.W. Bush took advantage of that and slashed the nuclear arsenal, slashed the budget. And they were aware that some of those materials in the former Soviet Union were now poorly guarded, surrounded by a chain link fence and no guards because they weren't getting paid. And Democrats and Republicans cooperated to pass something called the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Act. That's kind of a mouthful. But what it did was give aid to the Russians to help guard those materials, scoop them up, consolidate them, eliminate them, and prevent them from falling into terrorist hands. And guess what? It worked. There's a reason we haven't had a nuclear 9/11. It's not luck. It's not because we overestimated the threat. It's because we did something about it. But then we let everything slow down. We took our eye off the ball.
Where do you think the greatest threat is right now? Is it the heating up of tensions between Russia and the United States, or is it somewhere else? Is it India, Pakistan?
Every year I sort of do a rating of where our greatest nuclear threats are. What are the top five threats? And while I'm very, very worried about South Asia, that is not the top threat. Last year, I awarded the top threat to the arms race, just what you pinpointed. It's this competition. And I think both sides do it for partially good reasons. They want to prevent a nuclear war, partially for material reasons. People make money off of nuclear weapons. And both in Russia and the United States, we have contractors who keep proposing new weapons, and we have leaders who approve them, and these are billions of dollars. We spend $55 billion on nuclear weapons every year in the United States and related programs. $55 billion. That's more than we spend on the State Department, just for nukes. That's a lot of money. We have plans to spend almost $2 trillion over the next 25 years. That is a lot of money that could be going to other places. And while you're doing this, for good and for bad reasons, you run the risk of miscalculation, accidents, or a conventional conflict spiraling out of control and somebody popping off a nuke first. Now, we haven't done that for 74 years. It's been 74 years, and we have never again used a nuclear weapon since World War II ended. But that doesn't mean we never will. You got to be a real optimist to think you can keep 14,000 nuclear weapons in fallible human hands and something terrible won't happen. It will. So we have to take this moment that we have, this opportunity when we can safely reduce, to reduce the numbers, change the policy, save some money, save the planet.
Are you hopeful that maybe not in our lifetimes, but at some point there will be zero?
I am. I think nuclear weapons are an historic accident. You know, we started the nuclear program, the Manhattan Project, because Albert Einstein wrote a letter to Franklin Delano Roosevelt warning him that Hitler seemed to be determined to build this weapon of a new type, as he called it. The fission process had just been discovered, but they were afraid that Hitler was already onto it and had some very capable physicists in Nazi Germany. And so eventually FDR did start the program. But by the time we had built the bomb, we had already defeated the Nazis. And there was no German program, nothing of any consequence, nor a Japanese program. You know, if we hadn't started the Manhattan Project, we wouldn't have had the weapon, we wouldn't have been tempted to and then use it, and we wouldn't have ignited an arms race. Because a mere 4 years later, the Soviets match our capability, and then we're really off to the races, and that's when we go nuclear nuts and we're pumping these things out like sausages. But when you look back, you realize this is like 20th century science. You know, people built nuclear weapons listening to Glenn Miller using slide rules, you know. There's no big secret about this. And modern warfare has very little to do with nuclear. And there are some new threats, some new technologies, drones, cyber warfare, extremely fast, stealthy delivery mechanisms. And I think we can get rid of nuclear weapons the same way we've gotten rid of these other 20th century weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons. This was George H.W. Bush started a treaty called the Chemical Weapons Convention that banned chemical weapons. No major country, in fact, very few countries have chemical weapons at all. Nobody certainly brags about them the way we did. When I was in the Congress and working on professional staff of the House Armed Services Committee, there were big fights about a new generation of chemical weapons in the 80s. Gone. We no longer have biological weapons. We used to. We used to have enough toxins to kill every man, woman, and child on the planet. Richard Nixon got rid of them. Started a treaty, get rid of biological weapons. There is a treaty right now being ratified by nations in the United Nations to ban nuclear weapons the way we banned biological and chemical. It's called the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. I'm a supporter of that treaty. I think it's gaining ground. They've got 129 nations who have signed it. They need 50 to ratify it, and they're more than halfway there. So I think that treaty is going to come into law, into international law. None of the nuclear weapon states are part of it yet. But that's kind of the moral pressure and the political and diplomatic pressure you build. So, yes, I think eventually we're going to realize these weapons are just too dangerous or too unusable or too expensive, and we got to get rid of them.
Joseph Cirincione is president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation that focuses on nuclear disarmament. He is the author of several books on the nuclear threat, and he's also host of Press the Button, a weekly podcast from Plowshares dedicated to nuclear policy and national security. Cirincione was in town earlier this month to speak at UW-Milwaukee, and he stopped by our studio then.